The following program is produced and furnished in conjunction with John Gilroy of Lectromech, which is entirely responsible for its content.
Welcome to Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy of Lectromech, providing solutions to design, certify, and maintain aircraft wire systems. Every week, John speaks with public and private sector IT experts about some of the IT trends and challenges facing agencies and industry. Now your host, John Gilroy.
Welcome to Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy here on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. We've got a full house today, ladies and gentlemen. We have two startups, and we have one of the founding partners for a group called Mach 37. You know, everyone's, you know, you read the news, you hear about cybersecurity, and everyone's worried about it from the government to commercial. And who's doing anything about it? Well, I think we have a lot of good stories here. There are a lot of startups that are actually doing something about improving the cybersecurity for the federal government and commercial world as well. That's why I want to bring in these folks. What we're going to start off with, we're going to start off with Rick Gordon. He's a managing partner at Mach 37. Rick, how are you today?
Good. Thanks for having me.
Give us a little thumbnail sketch of your background, how you wound up working for Mach 37, please.
Sure. Well, I've been doing security and security-related startups since 1999, and typically or almost always in early-stage companies. About the December of 2012, I went to the Center for Innovative Technology. Actually, I had a startup idea, and the president at the time, Pete Jobsy, listened to me pitch politely for about an hour and said, "Rick, we like your idea. But that's not why we want to talk to you." And he started telling me about this idea they had for creating an accelerator for security startup companies in Northern Virginia.
Just from 2012, 2013, when did it start then?
So we started in the summer of 2013. They had they spent about 6 more months after that discussion really getting the planning done and getting the funding in place. And as soon as the funding was in place, I was on board.
Yeah. You know, you can go around town here and find all kinds of incubators. Some are well-known, sure. Some are not well-known, some are involved in healthcare IT. So what is the differentiator for Mach 37?
So I can only tell you that I'm an expert on our accelerator. I'm not an expert on the others, but I can tell you what we think makes us different. The managing partners or the partners at Mach 37, we think like investors, which means that we don't think of it as a program for getting entrepreneurs in and out. We have a commitment to the founders when they come to the accelerator to help them not only get started and imbue them with a vision for their business to allow them to be successful, and also to allow them to raise capital. Generally between 60 and 70% of our companies go on to raise additional funding beyond our initial investment. So the formula seems to be working pretty well.
You might as well brag about the news from last week.
Which news?
There was a Virgil Security, I think.
Oh, sure. So that was actually, sorry about that. It was a couple weeks ago. Yeah, it was a big deal. Virgil was our first Series A investment, technology, really proving the formula. The technology originated from Northern Virginia, was two technical founders, and we specialize in technical founders. They came to us with an idea that we liked. We'd actually been talking about investing in this thing even before we were aware of the Virgil team. Made a small investment, allowed them to work for a number of months, really honing the business strategy, and then allowed them to raise a little bit more capital. They went off and executed, landed a terrific deal with a West Coast company that is a hot runner. And that allowed them to get the attention of a Series A venture capital firm.
That's the story to tell,
yeah.
You know?
We expect to repeat it over and over again.
You know, many of the listeners don't realize how humble you are. You went to the Naval Academy, you have an MBA. I mean, let's talk about your background here. You got a pretty good, solid background for this. You didn't just fall off the turnip truck, huh?
Well, I've been around for a while. That may be a kind way of saying I haven't figured out what I want to do when I grow up. But yeah, I've seen a lot of startups.
Yeah, a lot of listeners here work for the federal government and have a lot of respect for Navy graduates. I'll tell you that once. I sure do. So let's say Joe Schmo walks in your door and says, "I'd like to be in the cohort for next year." What's the process?
So we typically will interview entrepreneurs anytime. We run two programs a year. The expectation will be that the team would it's typically at least two people. We look for one strong technical founder, and then another founder that would perhaps embody those maybe softer business skill sets of an entrepreneurial team.
And you can go to Mach37.com and actually see photographs of, you know, the cohort for the spring and the cohort for the fall, right?
You can. There's a lot of activity going on there. We have some great photos on the website that sort of, you know, can show you the action that happens there.
And the hottest seat in town is apparently your office on the evenings. I mean, you have these large events where all kinds of people show up, don't you?
Yeah, it didn't really start out that way. We established a security leader dinner series, and just to be quite frank, we did a dinner because Paul Graham, who was the founder of Y Combinator, said you had to. And so since we were an accelerator, we adopted that tradition, and every Thursday night we had a dinner. And I quickly found out no one wanted to listen to me talk. And since we really only do six to seven companies at a time, they had been talking to each other all week. So I went and asked my friends, people that I'd known in the industry that had been successful, to come in and sort of share their stories with these entrepreneurs. Often these were, you know, senior level policy people, successful entrepreneurs, technologists that would come in. No one says no. By the way,
tell you how many people show up just last week. I mean, there's tons. It was like over 100.
Last night was over 100. It's typically over 100. When we first started this out, it was 10. 10 people sitting around having dinner and
so
having a group
the
discussion.
The food got better?
Well, so the food's not bad, and that is part of it. But it's just the region here cares about the mission of Mach 37 and creating this ecosystem that is supportive of security product companies. And they come. And so what started out is being just a roundtable discussion is now this really vibrant network of security business people, policymakers that want to interact with our founders.
And the important part, people fly in from Texas and California to come to our humble location here out in Virginia. And it's really the quality of people you have speaking at these events. It's not too shabby.
It's humbling. It really is humbling the fact that the community has really embraced what we're trying to do.
So if you're listening to this and there's snow on the ground and you're thinking about basketball playoffs or something, they can go to Mach37.com and apply or contact you, or what's the process?
The best thing to do is go to the website and apply. We will contact you immediately after that to help answer any questions. We typically will have a number of conversations with founders before they decide to come. And, you know, by that point in time, we will have established enough of a relationship with the entrepreneur to know that it's a really good opportunity for them and for us.
So who picks who?
It's dating. It's definitely mutual.
Speed dating or something, huh?
It's definitely dating. Yeah. You know, we pick founders that we like, that we think are coachable, that are doing something that we think is disruptive, solving a real problem that is large and addressable. And oftentimes these are because the venture environment is really difficult for first-time founders and technical founders. We really specialize in them.
And if you're listening to this and you're in Kansas or Chicago or Cleveland, I mean, you have groups that are from North Carolina. It's not just limited to the D.C. area, is it?
No, we have a group of five going through now, and one of the companies is from London. Another of the companies is from Barcelona. The last class, we had a company from Turkey.
Yeah,
it's not unusual for us to pull in companies from all over the U.S. and the world.
And that's the strength, I think, of federalnewsradio.com is that if this gets tweeted out to someone in Brazil could listen to this, or someone from, I don't know where, maybe a strange place like maybe Maryland, and wind up applying and working with you. I think the flexibility here is really amazing, because 5 or 6 years ago, I would never imagine something like that. It seems so flexible and adaptable, but that's in cybersecurity, that's characteristics you have to have.
It is. The one thing I think when we founded Mach 37 hypothesized was that the richness of the cybersecurity talent in this region would basically provide the feeder system. What we really underestimated was the richness of the innovation within the cybersecurity and hacker community worldwide that wanted to come here.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
Well, later on this hour, what we're going to do is we're going to take out individual members of the cohort and do a 10-minute interview with them. And then at the end of this the hour, we're going to have everyone have a free-for-all and talk about maybe some of the challenges in starting up and where everyone sees themselves in a few years. And maybe what's interesting is where Mach 37 sees themselves in a few years. And I'll give you – you had 30 seconds to tell me exactly where you're going to be in 5 years. Can you imagine that question?
Right. Yeah. So I have half an hour to study for that?
Yeah. No, maybe in 5 minutes, John. Okay. Yeah. It's tough, isn't it? I mean, 5 years ago, you couldn't predict where you're at now.
No, I would even say 3 years ago, I would say people asked me about what we were doing. I said, well, we're not, the answer was, well, you know, we think we might be good at this. We have no idea. We're really sure we're good at this right now.
Oh, obviously. Yeah. Let's take a break, come back.
Thank you.
We'll bring in a couple of companies that you're working with in the cohort for fall, which is F-16. Aerospace engineers know what that's all about. And then I'll make a transition, have a free-for-all at the end. You are listening to Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy here on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. In the studio, just had a quick conversation with Rick Gordon, managing partner at Mach 37. Welcome back to Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy here on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today we're talking about innovation and creativity. We brought in some folks from an innovation hub. The name of the innovation hub is Mach, M-A-C-H 37. They're just out in Virginia. And we spoke to one of the managing partners of Mach 37 earlier, Rick Gordon. What we did is we dragged in one of the people who are part of the cohort here for fall of 2016. And if you go to Mach37.com, you'll see this little countdown for F-16. It's got nothing to do with aircraft. It's got a whole lot to do with the fall cohort. But before we begin, our guest here is Jason Wagner. The name of his company is Tensor Wrench, T-E-N-S-O-R. W-R-E-N-C-H, Tensor Wrench. And Jason, tell us about your background, how you wound up founding this company, please.
Thanks for having me. So I've worked with analysts for years, and what we've continuously noticed is they have like 15, 20, even 30 browser tabs open, applications they're working across. And as an industry, we've gotten really good at putting data together in the server room, but it's still overwhelming to those users. So what we do is take those applications, make them work better together. So there's less copying and pasting. There's just more flow, and the analysts can actually focus on the problems they're trying to solve.
So your catchphrase is data integration for humans, not servers.
Absolutely.
That's practical and down to earth. Mm-hmm. So what happens is if an analyst or a software developer, who would typically use your tool?
So we're really looking at cybersecurity analysts, the people who are running in SOCs, managed security services and whatnot. But they're taking these data, like network events or potential security events that are coming in, and they'll select a piece of text and copy it, and they're correlating this across all the threat intelligence, all the other stuff they have. And we're just about just taking the existing tools, tying them together, and eliminating that copy-paste, eliminating the busy work, because we're finding 30% of their time is just spent shuffling this stuff around.
If you drive into Washington, D.C. from Virginia on Route 66, there used to be a company, I don't know if it still is, called Silo Smashers. I love the name of that company, you know? So I should call you a Silo Smasher.
That's an option, yeah.
Yeah, I guess that's what you do. And so is it a service? Is it a utility? Or what? If you're listening to this and you're going to your website and seeing what you have, what exactly do you provide for my listeners?
So we're a service. Software is a service. You come in, subscribe. But to a large degree, we're trying to be invisible, right? You've got enough applications on your desktop as it is. You're dealing with enough stuff. If you've got 15 you're struggling with, a 16th is not going to help you. So you come in, you subscribe to the service. There's a quick process. There's a browser plugin we can put in to give you integration of those applications or plug in from those for the applications themselves. And everything just starts flowing better. I mean, that's really the goal. No long integration cycles, no retraining on the apps. We just want you to start producing results, not fighting your own tools.
When did your company open up?
So a little over a year ago, spun off. So we did a lot of work in the intelligence community, which is where we learned a lot about analysts. But we kind of took this and really looked at the use cases outside that kind of matched up and found a good fit there.
So what we have here is we have disparate parts of information, people trying to fit all these different pieces of puzzles together. And so you approached Mach 37, or they approached you, or how'd you even find them?
Oh, it was a little bit random, actually. I went into the CIT to talk to some of the small business folks that are in the other tower, and they said, well, you got to meet these guys. And I go down, and Bob Stratton, one of the partners there, had actually ran an investment for a previous company I worked for, and we knew a lot of people and just got talking and ended up pitching, and it worked out.
Well, fortuitous, so, huh?
Very.
The big fancy word is serendipitous. So what stage you're at now? So what happens with Mach 37 is these cohorts are a group of individuals, but there's also a time frame, like a 90-day time frame.
Yeah.
And if you go to Mach37.com, there's a little countdown. And so where you're at the countdown, halfway through the cohort or all the way through?
So I was actually in the cohort last year. So I was fall 15. Mm-hmm. So I graduated back in December of last year.
Okay.
And since then, we're really been vetting a lot of use cases, having a lot of conversations with customers, and just making sure we understand the problem fit, because we're definitely approaching this problem from a different angle than is traditional. So now we're really chasing those pilots, you know, getting our POCs and pilots going up and doing more than understanding the use case. We're getting in there and tying these apps together for folks.
I always like posing the what if question, the subjunctive question. What if Mach 37 didn't exist? What if you had just been on your own and trying to start up? What assistance did it provide you from a startup perspective?
TenSyringe would have shut its doors, and I probably would be back in doing the federal contracting stuff again. But no, it was significant for us in terms of learning and really putting together the model. I mean, we're technical folks. It's where we started from. So learning how to run the business, learning just all the things we didn't know, gave us a handle on things and kept the doors open. And I'm
in the classroom a lot, and if I have 15 students, there's 15 different ways they want to learn. You know, mm-hmm. many times they hate textbooks. And in fact, if I show a textbook, they start throwing tomatoes at me. But if I bring in a human, like a 32-year-old entrepreneur, then they finally have a conversation. They learn. And what Mach 37 does is they throw all different types of people at you, tall and short and skinny and fat and East Coast, West Coast. And no matter what your learning style is, there's got to be someone you're going to connect with in that program. It's going to help your business.
Absolutely. And I think back to the kind of engineering mindset. I come in, and one of the first folks we had was talking about branding. Branding's a feeling. And, you know, there's kind of that engineer mindset of, oh, this is like soft mumbo jumbo, but it's like, just sit back and relax into it a little bit. And then over time, it's like how everything ties together. And it's like that, it really is the foundation so much of making the company work, of just understanding what it is, where you're going and approaching it. Yeah, it definitely takes that hit from 20 different angles, from 20 different approaches to make it all gel together.
So last year you started the cohort, you finished it, and you still have contact with Mach 37. So mm-hmm. it's not you didn't move away to Utah. You still have relationships there and helping them out, and they're helping you still?
Indeed. I come in and steal a desk when I need a place to sit. It's a little quieter than my raucous home. So in there all the time. It's amazing the amount of support and the ecosystem that's built up around that for entrepreneurs. It really feels like there's a, not just the Mach 37, but all the people who come to the dinners. It just feels like a pent up desire to see this kind of entrepreneurship in Northern Virginia. And it's a little bit humbling, but it's really cool.
So where do you see yourself? I'm not going to say 5 years. We asked Rick 5 years. That's too crazy. Let's say a couple years from now. Do you physically want to have an office? Do you want to have employees? I mean, there's some people that don't want anything to do with employees. I mean, do you want where do you see? What kind of a business model do you see yourself falling into?
Oh, absolutely. So we're kind of changing how applications tie together. We're really looking at this from a different approach of instead of, you know, dashboards and composites and all this big data that we've done on the back end has increased the burden on users. So we want to continue to look at what an analyst is actually doing, sitting there in their bullpen or whatever their office is called, with the assets that they have, both their people, their tools, their creativity, and how do we put that together in new and unique ways that helps them get the job done, that doesn't get in their way and doesn't say, we're going to yank out what you have and put something new in. And so a laundry list of things.
Yesterday, I was speaking to one of my students who has an MBA and a master's degree in technology management, works for Booz Allen. He's a UI expert, user mm-hmm. interface. I almost want to put that label on you. You're almost a UI guy for analysts, you know? It almost fits in some ways.
And that's actually been one of the big challenges for us. We're the back end of the front end in many ways, right?
Now let's repeat that, Mr. Zen Buddhism. Yeah. Oh, the back end, oh, very deep, huh?
Well, I mean, you look at all these web applications that people are using. They're very, you know, they're applications. It's not just like a web page. You're not reading a Word document. It's an application. And there's a lot of stuff going on there. We kind of exist at that layer. So UX, that is huge, right? I mean, there's always a human in the loop. No matter what we do, no matter how much we change things, we can reduce the numbers, but there's always somebody making that decision. And we've kind of tend to forget that as a technologist sometimes.
And your target persona is not someone buying donuts from the smartphone. Your target persona is a very serious, methodical analyst that has important information. You have to understand them and how they would access different types of information. So it's same church, different pew. It's still user interface for easing their tools, their tasks.
But that same person goes and buys a donut at the end of the day. I mean, and it's what it is. And I ran across analysts in the past where they were using some tools we had done. And they're like, how do I move this from here to here? Well, you grab it, drag it, and drop it. Oh, well, I would have thought to do that at home, but I wouldn't have thought to do that at work.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that's kind of one of those things. It's like a lot of times when we're sitting there in the office working these things, we don't think about using those tools in the same way we would use something at home. So it's bringing those type of interactions together.
Yeah, the UI is always paired with UX, and this is the UX experience. And the problem is, if you just have a regular set of normal humans, you can figure it out. But many times, analysts, they're deep, serious thinkers, and they pull things up that you wouldn't think, and they try to associate things that don't necessarily associate, and so you have to adapt a system for them.
Mm-hmm.
That's fascinating. Let's take a break, come back, we'll talk to another company from Mach 37. You are listening to Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy here on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. We just spoke with Jason Wagner. His company is Tensor Wrench, TensorWrench, and his motto is data integration for humans, not servers. Welcome back to Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy here on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. We've got an interesting show today. What we did is we called up a local incubator and we said, hey, have the managing partner come out and bring in a couple of your talented fellas, and we'll talk about innovation and cybersecurity in the federal government. Many of my listeners are plagued with problems and they're trying to figure out solutions. And they come to Federal News Radio, they listen to interviews, they try to figure out what's going on, they go to conferences, and they occasionally actually call and contact people. And that's why we bring in different ideas and different thoughts to solve the problems that my listeners have. And the company we have today is called Threat Switch. And we have John Dillard from Threat Switch. How are you, John?
Great. Thank you for having me, John. Delighted to be here.
Give us a quick background on how you wound up with Threat Switch, please.
Sure, absolutely. I've spent my career in defense and intelligence, started out at CIA and had another company that I founded 10 years ago called Big Sky, focused on security. And I found that we had a lot of customers and ourselves had a problem with complying with federal security regulations. So I think, as your listeners know, we've had a spate of insider threat incidents over the last few years, Edward Snowden being the most well-known. And as a result of that, the feds dialed up rules and regulations that the 15,000 companies that have a security clearance of some kind have to abide by. So our product, in short, helps them build and maintain a program that gets compliant with those regulations.
Yeah. Many listeners know about HIPAA. The small targeted subset knows about these requirements. This is a very serious business here. This isn't light stuff, is it?
No, not at all. You know, it's a serious problem. I mean, insider threat is, we saw 2 weeks ago, we had another breach up at NSA from a federal contractor that I won't name. But it's a big deal. And the unfortunate thing is the contractors who do this work don't have a lot of tools at their disposal to make it easier to comply with these regulations that will protect the government information and those companies. So we're trying to help them with that.
I looked you up on LinkedIn, and your company's based in North Carolina. Is that where you live? You live here?
I do. I live in North Carolina, although I'm back and forth all the time, in part because of Mach 37. But also, I have another company that I own that operates here in the Washington, D.C. area.
So I assume you're North Carolina because the barbecue's so good.
That is a primary reason. It's family, and I'll tell you, as we build out our company, you know, there's a fantastic tech community in North Carolina that you can build from for tech talent.
Oh, yeah.
Some great universities, and we are our vision. Really, for our company, is to have our sales and marketing team here in Virginia, which is a seed for cybersecurity companies and security-oriented companies, and have a technology team in North Carolina.
Well, look at SaaS. They're down there. They can just draw them from that. And the young people can buy houses and work in technology. I think that's a great place to be.
Mm-hmm.
So, how did you stumble on Mach 37, and why did you choose them?
Oh gosh, well, there are two main reasons. Number one is a vertical accelerator makes a big difference, and Mach 37's focus on cyber is a little different. You see a lot of accelerators that are general startup accelerators. You have things like Techstars and Y Combinator that are rather general, and there's nothing wrong with that. But I think that the amazing thing that Mach provides is this instant plug-in to people who understand the business that we're in that's unmatched for what we do. So that's one part of it. And the other part of it, quite frankly, is the personal referral that I got to Rick Gordon and to the other partners there. And that means a lot because once you're part of the cohort, you realize that they are part of your team. They are out there putting their reputations on the line to help you be successful, which is something that I don't think you get at every accelerator.
And I try to tell the young people that people do business with humans, maybe not a website or a book, but human beings. And if there's a certain trust factor you have, and I've met a lot of people out there, and certain, I guess, is it a comfort level? I don't know. It's a comfort level. There's good things going to happen, and they've proved that good things can happen to that organization.
Absolutely. And Rick mentioned that earlier. You know, I think he said that it's a little bit of a dating process between the accelerator and the founder, and there has to be a good personal fit, and we have to believe in each other for the whole arrangement to work, and I think we've got that.
What would you have done differently in the early stages, the incipient stages of your company?
Gosh, you know, it's tough. I'm not a regret guy, but I would say I made a big mistake. I thought our product would be really appealing to mid-sized companies that were small and maybe didn't have big professionalized security operations for industrial security, and I was wrong. Big companies are very interested. Our first two signed customers were pretty big. They're larger than 2,500 people. So that's been fantastic, and I wish I'd known to talk to them sooner. So I'd say that, you know, for small companies, don't sell yourself short to go talk to that big guy because it might be a buyer.
In a world full of acronyms, the acronym I think of is GRC when I think of compliance. Is that your area there?
It's part of it. Really, what we're trying to do is provide a TurboTax-like experience for these security managers called FSOs. And I know there are people listening who know exactly what that is, Facility Security Officer. And to deal with this very specific federal regulation, these guys are not used to great tools. They're really used to things that are a little bit clunky to use, hard to manage. And we're trying to give them something that feels and looks more like what they use at home to manage their security program. So it's actually a bit more like a tool that you would use for taxes or like Rocket Mortgage or TurboTax than it is like a GRC product.
So you have a service you're selling then?
It's a software as a service. So you know, it's a website you log into, like TurboTax Online. When you set up an account and you fill out the forms and it spits out something that you hope will get you across the line when tax time comes around. And our product does the same thing, but for NISPOM compliance.
I was at your website, threatswitch.com, and the phrase that pays here is making compliance easier.
Indeed.
Three nice words. I like that.
Yeah, usually they don't go together very well.
Yeah.
And so that's what we're trying to do. It's very much about talking to these people who do this work every day and finding out, how do you do your job? What would make your life a little easier to get compliant with these regulations? These are important regulations that protect our companies and our country. Let's make it a little easier for them.
When I put my marketing hat on, I say, what a great you statement. Three words concisely, and the you is implied in
Thank
that.
Thank you.
At your website, the big words that pop up are inspections, reporting, training, and ease of use.
Mm-hmm.
And training's important, too, for all this, isn't it?
It is. It's a federal mandate, so they're required to do it. Every single one of those 15,000 companies has to train all of their employees, well, not just on insider threat, but on other security requirements. And it's pretty hard to keep track of all that. It's hard to get the training to them. It's hard to keep track of when they've taken it, if they've taken it. And it's hard to keep track of that in a way that you can report back to the federal authorities that regulate this. So that's a big piece of what we do, is deliver that training.
Earlier with Jason, we talked about dashboards, and this seems to be so complex. I don't know if it's a dashboard, but there's certain specific types of reports you can assist with as well. Is that right?
That's right. So you really, if you're a security manager or in a smaller company, you might be a senior executive who's accountable for industrial security. You need to know, hey, what's my training posture like right now? Are the people trained in the way they're supposed to be? Are there reports that have come in about foreign travel, foreign contacts, or other risky things that we got to look out for that I need to know about right away without having to sift through thousands of Excel spreadsheet lines? And that's what we do. We give them a snapshot so they can quickly make choices.
My avocation is reading history books. I read about the Middle Ages and ancient history, and many times in ancient times they had cities with walls around them. Some of these walls were 20, 30 feet thick, you know, and they thought they're pretty good until somebody on the inside let the bad guy in.
Exactly.
The insider threat.
Exactly.
And so where does insider threat fit in with your technology?
First of all, insider threat is not a new thing.
It's 3,000 years old.
It is definitely, you hit the nail on the head. A lot of people think it's a newfangled thing, but not at all. It's what we've been protecting ourselves against all along. It's gotten a lot more complex because of technology and because of the kind of behavior of individuals and travel and relationships that are different now than they were before. So our product is really looking for the things that the federal government has identified for us as the key things we got to look out for when it comes to insider threats. And there are guidelines they provide that we have to use to look at every single employee in all of our companies that do business with the federal government to see if those indicators suggest that this person is someone, it might not be a bad person, it might just be suggestive of something we need to look at. So what our tool does is take a look at those federal guidelines and highlight those people and events that could be most risky and require further investigation. So again, it's about making it easy because, you know, executives and companies, this is not their core business. We're trying to make it simple for them.
Yeah. I was in an office in Arlington this morning, and I was talking in the lobby to someone, and a gentleman walked with a suit and tie, had a badge, and they were looking at individuals in the office for a lot of different reasons. And I was kind of surprised. And I thought about the inside threat right there. It's very subtle, and some things have to be done face-to-face. And this individual came in, and he was going to look at some things physically rather than virtually. And so there's many different levels for evaluating someone's capability, and the insider threat's got to include all of those.
There really are. And a lot of attention is paid to the network and what happens on the network and in applications and in technology, and that's important.
That's fine.
It's absolutely important. But if you'd separate it completely from other things like travel patterns, like behavior patterns, We've seen what that gets us. I mean, Fort Hood is a really good example of someone who, you know, it wasn't a technology thing that would have detected his risk level. It was, you know, really his behavior at work. So you got to pair both those things together to have a shot at detecting insider threats.
And even trying to figure that one out, that was a needle in the haystack couldn't have been predicted at all unless things have changed. Let's take a break, come back, and put all three gentlemen together and talk about some of the challenges inherent in startups and the whole idea of cybersecurity here with the federal government today. You are listening to Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy here on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. We just spoke with John Dillard from a company called Threat Switch, talked about some of the insider challenges that you have in the federal government. Welcome back to Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy here on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Kind of a different show for me today. What we did is we brought in an incubation hub from Virginia in the studio. We had the managing partner in talk about the organization in general. And we have a person from one cohort last year's and a person from this year's cohort talked about startups and cybersecurity and problems that they solve. And what I wanted to do is just open mic night, get out your guitars, open mic night, and talk in general about startups. Because I know there are people who are listening to this podcast right now, this radio show right now, and are thinking, well, you know, I've got 20 years in the federal government. I kind of know what the problems are. Maybe I'll retire and start a company and solve this problem or that problem. And then what? What's the next step? So that's the question for you, Rick. So let's say you're at my house for barbecue and you're talking to Mary Smith. And she says, I've just worked 20 years for the federal government. I have an idea for solving this problem. And you turn to her and say, study finance? Or what do you turn to her and say?
Well, I turn to her first and say, well, what problem do you think you're trying to solve? If she's, you know, spent a lot of time, you know, dealing with this problem in the day-to-day, I suspect she's probably has a pretty good idea of what the problem is.
And I think that's what the listeners should know is that, you know, if you've been in the military for 20 years, you have a pretty good idea of the challenges that soldiers and airmen have, and you might be able to provide a solution to them when they get out.
That's right.
So, Jason, my question is, if you're at the barbecue, woman comes up to you and says, I'm thinking about something, do you say run away or stick with an employer rather than start a company? What are the advantages and disadvantages of having your own company?
I could actually say both, I guess. You know, but you have to really consider, it's like, what are you in it for? And it's a certain level of passion and disregard for the probabilities on doing it, but I found it to be a lot of fun, and if you can take the risk, it's worth it. It's well worth it.
Yeah. So, John, is the risk worth it?
Absolutely. You're asking the wrong guy. I've been doing this for about 10 years. So I've won my second company. My wife has a company. It's the most rewarding thing we've ever done. And not just because the company and solving the problem for customers, that is great and it gets you out of bed in the morning, but the community of entrepreneurs, not just in places like Mach 37, but once you start a company, other entrepreneurs come out of the woodwork to help you out. And it's really rewarding. It's a great community to be a part of, regardless of what kind of business. It doesn't have to be a software company. If you want to get out and start a business, it's absolutely worth it. Would recommend it for everybody.
I was raised in a neighborhood where you put a hood up in a car and we called Shade Tree Mechanics and you try to put an alternator in. And neighbors would always come over and, hey, got a wrench for you. I've got a 9/16 wrench for you. And it seems like that's what we have. It's like Shade Tree Mechanics in cyberspace, isn't it?
It is. You know, any place where you're around like-minded people that, you know, share a passion for the same thing that you do, I think you're going to find an abundance of help. And I think you certainly see that in software in abundance and in certain geographic ecosystems. Which everyone knows as being Silicon Valley, perhaps Boston to a, you know, slightly lesser degree. In this region, what we had was, you know, an abundance of knowledge of cybersecurity, and we sort of brute forced the whole software, you know, building the software company ecosystem. For the last 3 years, we've just been building it.
Jason, I was at an event yesterday. I heard Dr. Mark Busby from DOJ. This guy got a PhD in engineering. The guy's way smart. And he was talking about data centers. And I never thought that he'd make a statement. He'd say, you know, today we're machine learning and artificial intelligence, we're using that to manage a data center. So maybe that can be applied to cybersecurity as well. It's just this is a brave new world for me. Wow. AI for cybersecurity?
Absolutely. I mean, it's to some degree, the machine learning is I'm going to say buzzword, and it's an approach that's pretty common in there right now. And it's what you need, right? I mean, the whole point of computers is to automate things that you're supposed to do. And this is a way of learning how to do things that you would have done by hand without having to explicitly write out all the steps and just be far more adaptable than you could have been with any type of other technique.
John Dillard, in my world, there's something called attribution. So you have a website, someone comes to your website, you know exactly what drew them to the website. Mm-hmm. In cybersecurity, there's something called attribution. And so when someone says, I've got this email from a person here or there, and how can you attribute? This is one of the challenges in this rapidly changing world of cybersecurity, attribution. Does that impact your business at all?
It impacts every business. I think if you think about the kinds of threats, the complex threats that companies face, not just DoD contractors, but every company, every single time we fix one threat, the actors change the playbook, right? Hmm. And so, and we heard a talk at Mach 37 about this a couple weeks back. I mean, I think the key skill that most companies need to develop when it comes to outside threats or inside threats for that matter is constantly having the ability to diagnose what the trends are, not just this year, but this month, and what they can expect to see from bad actors. And if they don't have the capability to do that and they're not paying attention, they can get in trouble because they're pretty sophisticated. My own company, even a little company like this, gets attacked with routine phishing attacks. I mean, small companies are often the victims of these things too, and you got to stay on top of it.
Now, when you talked about changing and moving, I thought of a T-shirt I saw in Northwest a couple weeks back. It was a big, strong-looking guy's T-shirt said, stick and move. From boxing 101, stick and move. That's what you do. So that's what we have here. Isn't that right, Rick? People are sticking and moving. They're trying one attack, doesn't work. Try another one, yep. Doesn't work. And being inflexible, it's a death certificate.
That's exactly right. You've got to learn. One of the reasons why threat intelligence sharing or the sharing of different techniques from the adversary is super important. We've seen, an increase in sort of, you know, the sharing of that intellectual capital between large companies, but to, I think, a great degree, mid-sized companies and smaller than mid-sized companies are really left sort of flapping in the breeze. They aren't protected because they don't have access to this advanced information, much less the ability to actually use it.
Jason, I was watching TV last night looking for a ball game. It wasn't on, but I stumbled on this guy named Tom Wheeler from the FCC. Mm-hmm. And the story here is that they're going to companies have to be more responsible about collecting data. I think I don't think this is a very effective ploy. Where does this fit in as far as the threat landscape goes? Does this mean anything at all? Tom Wheeler saying we're going to have to ask permission to collect your data. I just think it's a silly thing.
It's a tough one, and it kind of goes both ways. I mean, I'm torn on this myself, right? I think privacy is important, and I think the company, corporations definitely have the edge on it. But at the same time, there's two people in every transaction, and who owns it equally. But it's a lot of responsibility because you never know what data, that personally identifiable data, is out there everywhere, and that compromises your own personal security. You know, my billing address is enough to get passwords changed in many places, and if that's being shared around, that's definitely a concern that needs to be taken seriously.
John, where do you see your business changing here in the next 3 or 4 years as far as compliance go, more and more training? Where do you think your business is heading?
Well, over the next 2 years, it's going to get significantly tighter. I don't expect that the spate of threats that we've had emerge over the last couple of years is going to change. So the federal regulations on companies that not just for security clearances, but for things like NERC, SIP, energy, any highly regulated industry, critical infrastructure, the screws are going to get tightened for sure. And some of the things we've talked about earlier in the session, artificial intelligence and machine learning, the only way to solve the problem for these industries is to build those kinds of tools into our platform. Even a software product like mine that's really a UI and ease of use story, we are looking at ways to build in AI and artificial intelligence, machine learning to enhance the kind of predictive analytics we can provide to our customers. It has to be done or you can't solve the big problem.
One big problem, Rick, that people have is in the next 6 months, there's going to be a big change. We know that Mr. Obama is going to be gone and someone's going to be in. What advice do you have to my listeners as far as cybersecurity goes for this kind of changing environment here? Just put your head down. What do you suggest they do?
It's a good question. Without, unveiling my political leanings, I would say, from an entrepreneurial perspective, there's never not a good time. You know, and one thing we've seen in even in the cybersecurity space, when 2002 rolled around, I've seen companies that started at that time are now billion-dollar cybersecurity companies. When 2008 rolled around, another recession period, I saw, in fact, participated in companies that started up at that point of time and are now, you know, $200 million companies. So, you know, don't let macroeconomic factors sort of discourage you. The economics of funding rounds will change. But the needs of people and their ability to actually, you know, pay for things, as long as you manage your cash flow, will never change.
And so there's never a bad time for a startup.
Never a bad time for a startup. Just have to operate a little bit differently.
Yeah. I never thought of the constraints for funding and everything else, but that has to be – I keep thinking of technology innovation. And if you want to learn more about innovation, I suggest you go to MACH37.com. You can troll around, see pictures of previous cohorts, maybe try to get an event if you can get a ticket. I think we have to have maybe an envelope full of money to get in one of these events. It's so popular. People are flying in from all over the place.
It's not true. It's not true. They're all free.
They're all free. We know that. I'd like to end the show here. We've been listening to the people from Mach 37. I'd like to thank our guests today. We have Rick Gordon, managing partner from Mach 37, Jason Wagner from Tensor Wrench, and John Dillard from Threat Switch. Gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thank you, Jason.
You've been listening to Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy of Lectromech, providing solutions to design, certify, and maintain aircraft wire systems. If you miss any part of this program, you can hear the entire show on our website, federalnewsradio.com. Federal Tech Talk only on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM.